Okay, good to see everybody this morning. This will be our fourth lesson on the topic of marriage laws and divorce laws, marriage in general. This will be the last of what I've been thinking of as background information. As I've mentioned several times, I'm approaching this topic differently than I did in 1998 and again in 2008. Those recordings are still available. I hope you'll avail yourselves of them. But always before, I had gone through 1 Corinthians 7 first, in both cases I think in three lessons, and then backed up to look at the Old Testament material. And so I was determined this time that we would go in chronological order. So we've just backed up to the beginning and are looking at God's relationship with the human race, and not just the Jews, but the human race back in antiquity prior to the time of Moses and his receiving the new law on Sinai. But I need to clarify something. You know you're in trouble when you sit down after a Bible class and your wife leans over and she says, you know, I think you were wrong on that and you misunderstood this individual. So, oh, okay, what happened then? So we've talked about that. I realized that, it slips of the tongue, I guess, but didn't make myself plain at all. So very quickly, let me just say that when I ran out of time at the end of the class, I may have left a misunderstanding. So first, there was law before Moses. And we all agree on that. Romans chapter 5 says so. It's absolutely unavoidable. Where there is no law, there is no sin. There is no death. But there was sin and death. Paul's whole argument in Romans chapter 5 is that there had to be law prior to Moses meeting God on Sinai. And then we've learned that that was an instinctive law. It was a law that you could do by nature. When Paul's discussing it in Romans 2, he says that the Gentiles who do not have the law can do by nature or instinct, depending on your translation, the things that are in the law. So we made some points about that, of course, that not everything can be understood instinctively. You wouldn't build a temple instinctively. But there are some things, some group or body of things, that God has apparently placed within us instinctively to understand this is wrong, this is right. So what I was trying to say is that there was, at least in the biblical record and in the historical record, secular record, there is no written law for the Jews, nor one we can find as identified as God having written and delivered to mankind prior to Moses. With the coming of Moses is not the birth of law, and it's not the beginning of a law you could do by nature. It's just the first time we have this written law that God has revealed to humankind. And I may have contributed to that mistake with an error I made in this chart. So along those lines still, looking at just matters of fact in Genesis. We're looking at things before Moses. And with regard to sexual activity in your Bible, in God's record, prior to Moses, we have in chapter 4 the first instance of any sexual activity, Adam and Eve. We have the first instance of incest, of course, because their children are marrying and going to populate the whole earth. Well, they weren't marrying aliens, you know, from Mars. They're marrying people. Where do those people come from? And there is obviously only one explanation. They, in the beginning, though later it would be forbidden, were permitted to marry within their family. So it was the only choices they had. We also found our first instance of polygamy, and as you see in the right-hand column, none of these things were wrong. But in the next two lines, in Genesis 12 and in Genesis 20, where in both cases Abraham misrepresents his relationship to his sister, his half-sister Sarai, he's married to his half-sister, expressly forbidden later, not forbidden at the time, it's a blessing at the time. I had the first instance of coveting a wife and the second instance of coveting a wife with Pharaoh and Abimelech and Abraham not being, you know, forthright about the fact that he was married to Sarai. What I should have said is that these are the first two instances of taking another man's wife, not of coveting another man's wife, but of taking another man's wife. And I'll show you why once I just finish this chart and we get to the next one. We also in chapter 34 had our first instances of rape and harlotry, and these were wrong. So all we did was look before Moses, there was some kind of a law. But and they knew some things were okay. God never criticizes it. Nobody condemns it. But other things were wrong, and everybody's upset about it, whether you're a child of Abraham and in his lineage or not. Now, what I wanted to straighten out again is, ran out of time, may have left this misunderstanding. Some things are known instinctively. There is some group or body of laws that you can understand and do by nature, but not all things are known instinctively. So as I mentioned a moment ago, here's that passage in Romans 7:7. Paul says, I would not have known about coveting if the law, and the only law we can be talking about is Moses' law, unless Moses' law had not said, you shall not covet. It is with Moses on Sinai in the Ten Commandments of Exodus 20. The humankind discovers, the only way they can, that not only would taking another man's wife be an evil thing, but coveting her would be also. This, of course, lusting after her. So I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, you shall not covet. So all I'm trying to say is, in this old law, prior to Moses, these people were so responsible to these instinctive understandings that they could die and would, that's the punishment, both physically and eternally, if they did not obey that instinctive understanding of right and wrong. So let's discuss what that law is. This chart, I'm going to go very quickly from last week and change up a little bit as well, not because I wanted to change it, but just to, I need to correct anything, but just to save time. From Adam through Christ and on to the end, we have this parenthesis in eternity where we have time. This time, we saw by Paul, is divided, and obviously is divided, into three very major areas, and then I've drawn an additional line to make four, because from Adam to Abraham in 1900 BC, there's a time frame that's distinct from Abraham over to Moses, a period of over 400 years. So in roughest terms, 1900 BC for Abraham, 1500 for Moses. But from Adam to Moses, there's just people. There is no Jew-Gentile distinction, as will be the case after Abraham through to Moses, as well as after Moses, all the way to the time of Christ. So we need to recognize that in the beginning, when people came out of the garden and began to populate the earth and went off to become all these different nations, for millenniums before Moses, there was first, up to Abraham, just everybody. No distinctions racially. Then the Jew-Gentile distinction is established starting in chapter 12 of Genesis. Abraham will become the father of those Jews, and then in promise, once Christ comes, he'll be the father of all nations as well. But from about 1900 BC to 1500 BC, we have the Jew-Gentile distinction, and they're separated and angry at each other in many instances. Then, of course, you have that enduring after Moses as well to the time of the cross, at which point we just come back to people again with the cross. It's mentioned in Ephesians and Colossians chapters 2, coincidentally both times, is done away a Jew-Gentile distinction. Are the Jews the chosen people of God anymore? No. Do they have any advantages or differences from everybody else on the planet? No. Does God expect anything differently from them or permit anything differently for them? Absolutely not. After Christ, we're back to just people again. So what we've discovered in our Bibles is that there's a universal moral law that you can know instinctively. I'm not going to take the time to develop this at length, and I think I've said that, you know, previously, but I believe this is because we're made in the image of God. We cannot live without His Spirit within us. His Spirit is His Spirit, and that Spirit is morally upright. It's pure. So we inherit by our nature, when we come into this earth, this portion of God's person and His moral system that we understand instinctively, a universal moral law. What I'm maintaining and certainly suggesting, and I think most people would agree, is that marriage laws would also fit into the category of moral laws, not ceremonial laws. Marriage law is not whether or not you should sacrifice the goat as opposed to the bull, or maybe, you know, the sheep, which one's pure, which one's impure, and which one do you need when you commit a particular kind of sin. You can't know these things instinctively. So God informs Moses and the Jews about those things, but marriage law has been going on since the garden. We understand you're making a promise to your mate. You're vowing and entering into a covenant that you will not violate except with severe penalties. And so you are exchanging promises, and you expect, I think morally, you understand instinctively those promises ought not to be broken. And so you find Pharaoh in Genesis 12, Abimelech in Genesis 20, and again, excuse me, later the same thing being done, actually three times, where we have a biblical character misrepresent his relationship to his wife so that another man is tempted to take her. Marriage law is covenant law, promises, honesty, being loyal, things that are moral, not ceremonial. So, by common agreement, everybody recognizes there was some kind of marriage law, because there's a lot of marrying going on, prior to Abraham in 1900 BC, when there's just people. That exact same law apparently still applies to all people, Jew or Gentile, from Abraham to Moses. But my conviction was, shared by a lot of people, I held it for about 23 years, was that with Moses' law, God gave the Jews a second law, a different law, and it was an easier law. I believed with all my heart for a lot of years that the Jews were kind of given a pass. They were allowed to divorce their wives for any cause at all. They were allowed to frivolously divorce their wives. They were allowed to easily divorce their wives. Nobody else was, because, as we'll see in the succeeding class, in Deuteronomy 5, Moses makes a huge point out of the fact that the covenant that was established between God and the Jews beginning on Sinai was not offered to anybody else. It wasn't even offered to these people. He says, this new covenant on Sinai, our forefathers worked under, but you Jews living in Moses' day and going forward, you will be. So, my conviction, very firm conviction, shared by a lot of people, God instituted the Mosaic Law. And in the Mosaic Law, He said, okay, for you Jews, I'm going to lower the standard. You can divorce your wives for any cause at all, whatever you want. But the Gentiles are going to be under the old law. They're going to be held to the higher standard. You Jews are not. That's what I believed. And then I believed that with the coming of Christ, and going back to just people, no Jew-Gentile distinction, that everybody was brought back under the first law. So, my conviction was that the Gentiles were always under some form of instinctive or natural law that was a higher law, particularly with regard to marriage, than the Jews were. That was my conviction. But as years went by, having not thought about those convictions very much, having inherited those convictions from men that I truly trusted, great Bible scholars, renowned, you know, and capable men, because they were my first teachers, I highly respected them. When they taught me these things, I accepted these things. Who was I to question? I was a young guy, 20s, 30s, 40s. You know, what? How could I dare? So I just believed it. But as time went by, passages I kept stumbling across began to bother me. Acts 10:4, I certainly understand now, God is not one to show partiality. But I believe he did. He was partial to the Jews, and he let them divorce their wives for any reason at all. Romans 2:11, there's no partiality with God. Ephesians 6:9, there's no partiality with him. Colossians 3:25, without partiality. 1 Peter 1:17, if you address as Father the one who impartially judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves in fear. So, you know, I think that's a part of God's moral virtue, core character. He's fair. He's just. And that seemed to me a problem with God saying, okay, for you Jews, though, you can shed your wives for any old reason you can think of. But the Gentiles, no. You guys are held to a higher standard. So that's what we want to talk about at more length today. And then, starting with next week, we'll start really boring into Moses' law and the passages that deal with law at that time. But for today, here's kind of the theme, which I introduced last week. Who can tell me what verses in the Old Testament say? Where can I read somewhere verses that are printed on the page that say that any moral law was ever changed? Where God said, well, you know, it used to be murder was wrong, but now murder's okay for the Jews, but not for the Gentiles. And then when Christ comes, murder's going to be wrong for everybody again. When did that ever happen? When did God ever make a distinction between Jew and Gentile and say, the Jews will be held to a lower standard, you Gentiles must remain under the higher standard, the one that was from the beginning? So, specifically again in this discussion, where is there any verse where God ever says in the Old Testament, I'm going to change the law for the Jews and let you guys shed your wives for any reason at all? I couldn't find it. I did find these things, though. So I'm not going to give you the verses. For sake of time, I need to go very quickly this morning, but you'll recognize every one of them. I believed my conviction was based on Matthew 19, which we won't study in detail. We will study in a lot of detail. But we won't study in detail until we get there chronologically. But because of my understanding of Matthew 19 for all those years, which I'd been taught by very respectable people, I believed that mankind had rebelled against God. They had hardened their heart against God. That's the phrasing in Matthew 19. And that as a result, God responded by saying, okay, if you don't want to serve me, if you want to be disobedient to me, if you're going to harden your heart toward me, then I'll change my law and let you have it your way. I hadn't thought about the consequences of that. But I was taught that, so I believe that. Then now, I've gone back to look in my Old Testament to see if I can find that. When mankind rebels, when mankind hardens his heart against God, what does God do in response? Well, with Adam and Eve, he threw them out of the garden. He didn't say, oh, well, okay, you know, if you want to eat that fruit and all, you know, then go ahead. He didn't do that. He threw them out of the garden. He made no allowance for their sin at all. When Cain kills Abel. Please notice we go through this chart. There's quite a number of these I left off where God was not personally involved in it. The list I'm giving you are only the ones where I have God's telling us how he felt about it and what he did about it. There are others where I think you can see people were doing instinctively, they were doing by nature what they understood in their own spirit because they were in the image of God. You know, was wrong, and would be the same thing. But these are only the ones where God's personally involved, makes some sort of declaration. When Cain killed Abel, he made Cain a wanderer. And he said, no man can kill you. Next time you go back and read about that in Genesis 4, remember, Cain was worried about being killed. But I'm not sure that that was some kind of blessing. Okay, what it meant was there was never going to be relief from him. He'd lived a good old long age, and he was going to be miserable. He was cursed from the ground, is the way it's described. No allowance was made for the hardness of his heart. Noah's entire world hardened its heart wholesale against God. And when God looked at an entire earth that was not going to do what he said, did God then lower his standard so everybody could have it their way? Did he make any concession to their sin, to their evil? Well, of course not. He destroyed the entire planet. There's no allowance made because they didn't want to serve him. He destroyed them because they didn't want to serve him. When Ham, son of Noah, one of his three, saw Noah in his nakedness, and we really wish we knew a lot more about this, but there's just a sentence about it. Whatever he did to him or about his father was cursed, is the word that's used. And he was made servant to his other two brothers. Absolutely no allowance on God's part is made because this man wants to do this evil thing. When you get to Babel in the 11th chapter, we're only 11 chapters deep, and we've seen five of these already. Now comes Babel. God had said, be fruitful, multiply, fill the whole earth. They said, no, we won't. We're going to stay right here, build a big tower, reach all the way up to heaven. We're not going to obey that command. God said, okay, well then, all right, build your tower, right? He said, okay, you're going to harden your heart toward me, you don't want to obey me, then I'll let you do what you want. No, no allowance is made. God comes down, confuses the language, they're scattered, and they're forced to obey God's will. They are not permitted to rewrite God's will. They don't influence God to change his mind and lower any standards. God punishes them. Pharaoh and Sarai, we already talked about in Genesis 12. Great plagues are visited by God upon Pharaoh. No allowance is made. In Sodom and Gomorrah, what happened? Now, brethren, we've seen this on a worldwide level twice. Here in Sodom and Gomorrah, we're seeing on a local level, on a city level. And we've seen it all the way down to a personal level. But with Sodom and Gomorrah, God didn't say, well, everybody wants to be homosexual, they want to rape people, they want to do all these things, so it's, you know, they're just hardening their hearts, they're not going to serve me. So what I'll do is I'll say rape's okay, homosexuality's okay, but just for them and just for 15 centuries. No! There's no allowance made whatsoever. What happened to Lot's wife when she looked back on it? Well, everybody's curious. How hard would it have been not to look back? Pretty hard. So hard she couldn't stop herself. When he turned her into a pillar of salt, that's a direct and divine punishment. No allowance is made. How do you suppose that Lot felt about that? I won't even get into what his two daughters decided they needed to do about it. So, you know, what was God's allowance there? From an individual family through cities to an entire planet. Where in the Old Testament does God ever scratch his head and say, well, what do you know? They don't want to serve me. They've hardened their heart against me. So I guess I better let them have their own way. I guess I better lower the standard. Now finally, brethren, you know, I was getting all of this from my teachers, and I was getting it erroneously out of Matthew 19 because of this expression, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, permitted you to divorce your wives. And I believed what they taught, and I believed it in good conscience, that if you harden your heart toward God, then God will lower the standard. But he didn't. When we get this hardening of heart as an expression for the first time in your Bible, it's repeatedly ascribed to Pharaoh. It is against both Moses and against God. And what's he get? He gets 10 plagues. He doesn't get a pass. He gets 10 plagues. There's no allowance made. His firstborn son's going to die. And then, I made this a second time because it came up again with this heart of heart expression, but what also happens to his whole army, and apparently him as well, I'm presuming he was at the head of his army there, They get down in the water, you know, crossing the Red Sea, and now they're all drowned. Well, couldn't God see that they didn't want to serve him? So, God is beholden to lowering the standard for them, isn't he? These things were really adding up for me, brethren. There is no such allowance ever stipulated in the Old Testament. So I'm asking you again, if like last week, if I misunderstood somebody or something, the whole point of my teaching these lessons is that I have, yeah, 21 years ago I changed my mind after 23 years to believe in something else, I'll change. But brethren, doesn't it just kind of make sense that if God was going to do such a radical thing as to say, I am going to select for me a chosen group of people. I'm going to separate them from everybody else. And when they don't want to serve me, I'll rewrite my law so they can have what they want. You would think he might have made some kind of comment about that somewhere in the Old Testament if in fact he'd ever done it. What verses in the Old Testament say that any moral or any marriage law was ever changed? Please find that for me. I was sure that a single verse in the New Testament said it had happened. But I also could not find anywhere in the Old Testament that said it happened. So now, here's where we were. I was. I believed with all my honest heart. I believed it. And I taught it. I've even counseled it in test cases where people were in the circumstance. I believed that God for the Jews for 1500 years in Israel changed and lowered marriage law. Not just that he changed it, but that he lowered it. And what he had once hated, what he had once, you know, thought of as evil, what had once offended him, he was going to let the Jews, but not the Gentiles, do with impunity. No punishment for it. You get to have it your way. I also believed that this easy divorce was limited to the Jews. This was my conviction, as it was the majority opinion for all those old years. What I hadn't done was spent much time thinking about the consequences, nor had I seen any teaching on that topic. What this meant had never been explained. I can't think of a single place. Now, you know, I have been operating Truth on Disc since 1976. Since 1976, for 43 years, I've been recording Bible class material and distributing it worldwide. I'm in the business and have been for more than four decades of collecting the highest and best scholars that I can find in both audio and video formats. I have huge collections and exclusively, you know, scholars of immense reputation and ability that I've personally recorded or got recordings from other people. And in none of that can I find anybody talking about the consequences of this doctrine. That if you'll just harden your heart toward God, God will say, okay, give up and let you do your sin. I believed that. I couldn't find it anywhere. But I also hadn't thought about what follows. Now please stick with me on this one. Brethren, if what I believed was true, then for the Jews alone, and for only 1,500 years, the smallest section of time we have in all the Old Testament there, God allowed covenant breaking. You could take a vow, a marriage vow, and then you could just break it if you wanted to. You were still going to take marriage vows. You were still going to go through marriage ceremonies. You were still going to make all these promises. But if you wanted to break all those promises and you were a Jew, then okay, you got 15 centuries to do it. That now seems like kind of a radical thought to me, that God would have such little respect for covenants. Now, again, I've thought long and hard about this for this class, and I'm not going to do my whole lesson on covenants and covenant breaking like I just did in the previous list. So I showed you all these things where God never made an allowance when people wanted to sin. You can also go back into your Old Testament and find plenty of times where people broke covenants. Does God ever say, okay? Don't think so, brethren. Really don't think so. There's always punishments. There's always consequences. God respects covenants, and you have to keep them. Before Moses, during Moses, after Moses, God never said, well, if you don't want to keep your covenant, then okay, break your vows. For a little while, you special people of mine, you can have the lower standard. Number two, this is the one that screams out at me the most, I think, now. Has God so little respect for you wives? Okay, you men, you don't want to live up to your covenant or your vows. You've made promises. She's left her home. She's borne you children. But if you want to kick her out of the house, you go ahead. And you wives, deal with it, baby. Because we've come a long way, haven't we? We've come a long way, baby. We're under Moses' law now. Under Moses' law, no woman can trust her husband's vows. No woman can expect him to keep them. You'll make your vows and your covenant, and if you're absolutely faithful to it, but your husband just arbitrarily decides he doesn't want to, then okay. He gets to just cast you off and throw you in the gutter and send you back to daddy. Because you're out of here. You have no recourse. You have no respect. You have no value now in the sight of God next to the man's desire to disobey God and abandon you. I never saw a lesson on that, how the wives had to pay the price for that sin. And of course, what is concomitant? What about the children? What are we going to do with all these children? Husband decides, he's hardened his heart, he doesn't want to serve God, and he wants to kick the wife out. Take the kids, baby, because we've come a long way now. We're under Moses' law, and I'm a Jew. So get on out of here. Tough cookies, baby. God says, I'm a Jewish man, and I don't have to keep my vows to you or to the children that you've given me. So go home to your parents. Brethren, really? Why haven't we thought about this? And this also means, as a consequence, that God's not only partial, you know, but he is favoring the evil men. It's not that he would be partial to the wives or the children or the covenant. He just says, okay, no, I'm going to favor the men's hardness of heart and yield to that. Then the last one here. Brethren, fill in this blank for me. It's a New Testament passage. Let us do evil that good may come. Now, Paul took up the proposition in the Roman letter. Some were arguing. Let us do evil that good may come. A Machiavellian approach. I know what I'm doing is forbidden by God, but if I'll do it, I can imagine good things that'll flow out of it. What was Paul's response? Let us do evil that good may come. God forbid. He's just appalled at this prospect. This is just unthinkable. Okay, let us do evil that good may come. No! But how about this one, brethren? Let us do evil that evil may be allowed for 1,500 years. Has not God taught under my old conviction that if you'll just harden your heart enough, then what was a sin, even in many cases described as an abomination, if you'll just harden your heart enough, will for you no longer be a sin. You can practice that evil, that abomination, with impunity if you're one of God's chosen people, the Jews. But those poor Gentiles who weren't even under a written law, all they had was the old instinctive law, they won't be able to. But hey, you Jews, you're my people, God says. You're my children. My children, if you're male, get to break your covenants willy-nilly. You just have to harden your heart enough, and then I'll let you cast off your wives for any reason at all. then, brethren, some years passed, and now that I'm actually looking at these things and trying to find these ideas somewhere in my Old Testament when God supposedly made these profoundly radical changes in morality and in marriage law, I can find no place where God yields to man's sin or man's rebellion. Can you find one for me? Number two, I can find no place where God ever says that he's going to yield to sin, make an allowance, or lower his standards because of it. And besides this, and this is a thought that really only struck me here very recently, and then I started going back and thinking about it. I really do believe in providence and seeing things come together that seem to be unrelated and you don't recognize any tie or anything, and then later suddenly you're so glad that that happened over there because of what's happening now here. And that Leviticus class on Wednesday night, that's just like chief among them for me right now. We spent 18 weeks in the book of Leviticus. Now, those of you who have been in that class for 18 weeks, you're studying Leviticus. This is Moses' law being given on Mount Sinai 1 year after they left Egypt. They're only 1 year in the wilderness. It's time-stamped. Did Moses' law lower standards for the Jews in any way? Is there anything about Moses' law that will be easier than it was for Pharaoh and his Egyptians and the rest of the Gentile world? Moses' law, I'm thinking, is not a lowering of any standards as a concession to rebellion and sin. In fact, I've been doing a lot of work on this in recent weeks, I rather think now that Moses raised the standards for the Jews, and that's really the only thing that makes any sense. He called them out to, quote, wear his name. Is this what God wants to be known for? The Jews are covenant breakers. You can't trust a word they say because they've hardened their heart against their God, and their God says, okay, then you don't have to keep your marriage covenants. Is this what God wanted to represent to the world? Let us do evil, that more evil can come, and he won't criticize us for it? Is that what he did when he pulled the Jews off to become the light of the world? I don't think so. So, there's a great photo of Moses. In Romans 7, verse 7, I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, you shall not covet. Did God raise the standard for the Jews? Deuteronomy 5 says the Gentiles were not under that law. Did God raise the standard for the Jews or lower it? That looks to me like a significant elevation of law. Requirements that are higher, more stringent, deeper, require more effort, a higher standard of morality. Not a lower one. A higher one, starting with the Ten Commandments. In Exodus 25 through 30, we have all the tabernacle construction and all the priest clothing. You got six chapters there that's all about all of this new, sacrificial system that's going to take place. Was that more information, more difficult to do, far more costly and involved? Or was it a lowering of God's standards when it comes for atoning sin? Brethren, it was an extreme raising of the bar for the Jews, which the Gentiles were not under. It's exactly the opposite of what I thought. God didn't lower the standards and give the Jews a pass. He was raising the standards so they could wear his name and show the world what is God's nature, God's way. In Leviticus, the first seven chapters, we have an extremely elaborate sacrificial system to be practiced by these priests in that special clothing and with their purification rites in place inside this elaborate tabernacle. Is that more or less than the Gentile world? In Leviticus 11, we have all these dietary laws. We studied it on Wednesday nights. They're not inherently evil because later in Christianity, he'll do away with them. Why these laws? because the dietary laws set the Jews apart from everybody else. And it had to do with principles regarding purity and defilement and covenant relationship with God. You got to up your game. You have to be separate from everybody else. You can't do what everybody else does. More is being required of you, not less, for 1,500 years. Leviticus 12 through 15 is laws, icky laws, you know what we call them, about discharges and leprosy and scabs and all kinds of stuff like that. These were laws the Jews had and nobody else. More expected of them, not less. In Leviticus 18 through 20, you have the extensive definitions on sexual sins. In Leviticus 21 and 22, you have numerous priestly requirements. In Leviticus 23, you get the Sabbaths and all the other holy days and festivals that were incumbent upon the Jews, but not anybody else. In chapter 24 and 25, you've got Jubilee, you've got laws about poverty, you've got laws about slavery, which restricted these things. Required the Jews to show amazing faith. You can't even sow or reap a crop in that seventh year. You have to trust God to give you such a bumper in the sixth year that you can let all your land lie fallow for a seventh year, and that sixth year will allow you to eat in the sixth year, eat in the seventh year, and get you through the eighth year while you're planting a crop and coming to harvest. That takes a profound amount of faith. Same was true about, you know, the law of Jubilee. You bought property. Now you have to turn it all over and give it back to the tribal inheritors at the beginning. So, where do you find anything like that among the Gentiles? Excuse me. With regard to poverty, they had to take care of their people. They weren't allowed to just abandon them. And with slavery, there still was slavery, and slavery was perfectly legal. But if you were a Jew, could you mistreat your slaves? Could you take things away and deprive your slaves? Could the slaves be redeemed if a family member came and wanted to buy them out? It was much more elaborate and higher. So here's the point of this class, and really the preceding classes as well. Brethren, all that I had been taught and believed for 23 years is absent in the Old Testament. It's never mentioned. You cannot find what I believed God had done. He never says He did that. So now I've got some obstacles, you know, to be climbing over. If I'm going to buy out of one verse in the New Testament that God did all these things in the Old Testament to manifest to the world and the Jews less of a standard regarding sin than He did for the Gentiles, then now I've just got to get over that. How do, and why and where does God ever adapt His law to accommodate man's sin in these areas? If in all the Old Testament God lowered moral or marriage law, then, brethren, He never said He did. It'd be news to everybody in Matthew 19, because there's not a word about it anywhere prior to that. So if He did do that, He never recorded that He did that. Apparently He never said that He did that. There is no command, no express declaration to be found in your Old Testament about such lowerings. Number two, He never gave us an example of it either. There's no example. Number three, in the Old Testament, He never implied that He did. There's no inference to be found. There is no command. There is no example. And there is no inference about God lowering standards in response to the people hardening their hearts against Him in all your Old Testament, Genesis to Malachi. Number four, He would have yielded to sin. I can't find it. He'd have been partial to the sinners and not to those who obeyed Him. He'd have permitted covenant breaking. He'd have abandoned the wives and the children, and He would have allowed evil that more evil might come and be declared not evil for a little while. Then He's going to change it back. And you Gentiles, sorry, you'll just have to live like the wives and do the paying, you know, for this thing. And there's also these four bedrock principles that we'll be coming back to with a vengeance when we get in our verse by verse. It is better to marry than to burn, brethren. And that we find expressly stated in 1 Corinthians 7. But I got over that for 23 years. And I figured out a way that for some 25 to 50% of the American population, it was better to burn than to marry. And where in 1 Corinthians 7, they're told to stay in the condition in which they are called. 9 verses on the first one, 18 verses on the second one, out of a total of 40 verses is all there is in the whole chapter. I was teaching that they could not stay in their current condition. They'd have to divorce their current wives and their husbands, and then they'd have to go back to the first one. Number 3, forbidding marriage, Paul declared to Timothy, is a doctrine of demons, which doesn't sound very healthy. And then Malachi ends your Old Testament with a statement that God hates divorce. I think he hates everyone that ever took place. Even when he divorced Israel, I think he hated it. So, maybe less divorce is better than more divorce. Now, brethren, for all the list that I gave you back here, how many is that? 8 things for which there's no command, example, or inference. And with the 4 more that have been added right here, for all 12 of these things, here's what I've done in these last 4 lessons. All I've said is, this is the mountain we've got to climb. If Matthew 19:9 means what I thought it did for nearly 2.5 decades, then I've got to explain away 12 things that are pretty cardinal doctrines in my Bible. I thought I could for years, and I glibly did, though I had no scripture for it apart from a single verse in Matthew 19:9. Matthew 19. Okay. So, that's the end of our class, and I hope it's the start of your searching desperately to find those 12 things for me, so that I can feel good now about Matthew 19's complete redefinition of God and sin and what he did with his people in the Old Testament. Thank you.